Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Robert Pinsky is a tireless champion of poetry for the public. The former U.S. Poet Laureate, he's now a BU professor, has published more than 15 books of his own writing, and he's worked hard to expand poetry's presence in mainstream culture and to attract naysayers to poetry in unexpected ways.
While he was Poet Laureate, Robert Pinsky founded the Favorite Poem Project, in which thousands of Americans shared and read and spoke about poems they love. More recently, he's been setting his poetry to jazz.
Antique. I drowned in the fire of having you. I drowned in the fire of having you. I burned in the river of not having you.
Robert Pinsky has even made an appearance on The Simpsons, playing himself, giving a poetry reading. His latest book is called Singing School. It's an anthology of 80 poems by master poets designed to energize and inspire us to read, maybe even write poetry. And Robert Pinsky joins me in the studio now. And Robert, welcome back to Radio Boston. Really good to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
And I thought we should start with a poem. That seems only appropriate. So, as you told me before we went on the air, I could pick any one of these 80 poems and they'd all be all right with you. So I thought, why not start with Lake Isle of Innisfree by William Butler Yeats?
Good.
Oh, well, and before you read, give us a hint, something to think about. You are a teacher. I mean, what would you like us to be listening for?
I think just to listen to the vowels and the consonants. And not just the rhymes at the ends of the lines, but all the times. There's a lot of the poem, in a way, is written in the key of A, but it modulates into R, too. So I don't think there's any need to think any particular... There's no pedagogy needed here.
All right.
The Lake Isle of Innisfree. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree. And a small cabin built there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always, night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray. I hear it in the deep heart's core.
That's Robert Pinsky reading The Lake Isle of Innisfree by William Butler Yeats. He's here because he's talking about a new book, Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. This is a lovely anthology of 80 of his favorite poems from across time, from across styles and sounds. And listeners, we want to hear from you. What are your all-time favorite poems? What poems do you keep returning to and why? And which of the great masters inspire you? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and join the conversation with Robert Pinsky. Robert, the title of this book, Singing School, comes from lines from another Yeats poem, Sailing to Byzantium, and there's no singing school but studying monuments of its own magnificence. I'm curious how these lines capture the philosophy of your book.
I think you'll learn about, I assume that people who want to be film directors look at a lot of movies. And if you want to cook, then there's a certain way a cook eats. And I assume if you're interested in broadcasting, you listen to people who you think are very good at broadcasting. In a way, it's amazing that it needs pointing out that if you want to learn about poetry, a good book about poetry is The Collected Poems of Emily Dickinson, or The Collected Poems of William Butler Yeats, or William Carlos Williams, or Ben Jonson. And indeed, Yeats goes very far. He says the only way to learn singing is not just to sort of read things that are fashionable at the moment, or take a creative writing course, or to dabble, but to study monuments of magnificent singing. And that's the theory behind this. I try not to make it solemn. I feel like I need to point out that it's in the spirit of the book. The next page after that Yeats poem, there's a parody making fun of that poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree, by Yeats's friend and sometime secretary, Ezra Pound. The Lake Isle is the title of Pound's poem, and it begins, "O God, O Venus, O Mercury, patron of thieves, give me in due time, I beseech you, a little tobacco shop." And he says where the whores come in for a bite or two to fix their hair. "Install me in any profession save this damned profession of writing where one needs one's brains all the time." So I hope it's studying things that are magnificent, but also with some sense of play in the absurd.
There's a lot of encouraging in this book because it's not a typical collection of poems that centered around one theme or a time period. These are poems that you like, but you're encouraging us to read them sort of with fresh ears and to think about how they might inspire us even to write our own poetry.
Look, I have been fortunate enough to spend a lot of my professional life and personal life doing whatever I feel like doing. And in the introduction to this book, I say this book, I hope, will become obsolete for each reader because I hope each reader starts typing up poems. You can put it in a computer file called Anthology. What do you think are magnificent examples worth studying? So in a way, the book is, I hope it will inspire other people to make their own anthology.
And what's the best way to do that? You suggest a computer file or hard copies? Because I think sort of how to do it is sort of...
For learning, writing longhand is very good. But I would say once you find something you like, write it out longhand or type it out. If you type it on your keyboard, you can save it into your file called Anthology or Daybook.
And why write it out?
It forces you to read slowly. When you type something, you memorize it two or three words at a time, and you're giving it the authority of a little menial manual labor. And that process is really what I believe in. I'm happy to hear you say that I urge people to read poetry, but I really never – one reason I'm proud of the Favorite Poem Project is we never told anybody to read poetry at all. We asked –
Yeah,
we asked the merits, what's a poem you really love? And then we did the anthologies with the things they said about why and how they loved the poems. And we made the videos. So
it's interesting.
I don't believe in marketing so much as in asking people what they like.
Yeah. And no, it's interesting that you make the distinction. But just in the asking of what people like, you're reminding a lot of people who might not read poems like, oh, yeah, maybe I should be doing that, too.
Or if there's something you like in the way a certain sports writer writes or a political writer. Anything you enjoy the way of writing or in music. And this is pretty fundamental. This morning I was taking care of a four-month-old. And if you sing into the four-month-old ear very gently, he pays attention, he calms down, he's interested by that. Turns out, I've discovered with babies, you can recite poetry has exactly the same effect. For them, the relatively recent division between poetry and music, they haven't gotten to that yet. They're still back in the time when it's not just sister arts, but basically part of the same art with dancing.
But it seems like you advocate or encourage, suggest that we should listen to poetry in much the same way. I'm glad you brought up the idea of a four-month-old baby because in places in the book, I'm intrigued by how you say, don't get hung up on the meaning. Don't worry about the dictionary. Just listen to it.
That's how you start.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not an anti-intellectual person.
I don't think anyone would accuse you, Robert Pinsky.
I think eventually you will want to think. If there's a cuisine you like or a person you love or a kind of animal you're crazy about or a sport, eventually you will become quite analytical about that cuisine, that city, that sport, that person. But that's not how you become attached. That's not the first thing. It's not primary. And I think well-meaning teaching, well-meaning people have made it seem as though the primary thing with poetry is, what does it mean? What's that about?
Yeah.
Well, with my family and friends, I will always ask, what was that about? What did that mean? Even after they die, you keep saying that. But it's not how you become attached to them or interested in them. So it's not primary. The intelligence will have the appetite for analysis and information once you've kind of danced to it or gotten to love it.
You have a nice example of this, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, but the kind of freedom that you talk about to sort of feel and hear the poem, and you offer the great example by Lewis Carroll in his poem Jabberwocky, which begins, I'm going to try this. You do this much better than me. "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, and mimsy were the borogroves and the mome raths outgrabe."
What's great about that?
I was going to ask you.
Among the many things that's great about it is it demonstrates that just like sense, nonsense is never pure.
Yeah.
You can never purely make sense. There's always some little accidental grunt involved in what you're saying. Yeah. And you know what the parts of speech are. You get a rough idea even before Humpty Dumpty has explained it to you, what that's all about. And in fact, Carroll first published that stanza. That's all that he published before he wrote the rest of Jabberwocky. Mm-hmm. And he said, Stanza of Anglo-Saxon Verse was the title. And it's not a bad way, if you have people who want to learn meter, it's not a bad thing to say to them, well, try to write iambic pentameter with nonsense words. Hmm. The scorbel dabies tromed the vibindop until the scabadoobind hoard the boop. And those, you know, it's morphologically, it's English, takes the forms of English, and you don't distract yourself with the meaning.
Robert Pinsky, we've got a bunch of listeners who'd like to get on this conversation. Let me just remind them again, we're talking to Robert Pinsky. His new book is Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. This is an anthology of 80 of his favorite poems with some great guidance, I'd say, along the way from Robert Pinsky, the former U.S. Poet Laureate. 800-423-8255. Let's go to Michelle from Traverse City, Michigan, where we apparently have at least one listener listening on the web. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I'm listening on my iPhone. I have an app that I can listen to any station in the country.
Glad to have you aboard. What's on your mind?
Well, my favorite poet actually is my father, and he just dibble-dabbles in it here and there. He writes poems for us as his children and things like that. He wrote one called Please Don't Eat the Flowers, Children. And it's like a four-line poem, and it's hilarious. It's Please Don't Eat the Flowers, Children, because it isn't nice. And don't sleep with animals, because they'll give you lice. Eat lots of vegetables, because they're really good. But don't eat the flowers, children, because no one said you could.
Very nice, and Michelle.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have any idea what your dad has read in the way of poetry?
He's a simple, small-town guy.
We can bet, from your example, we can be positive that he has read quite a lot. And I suggest, if you are speaking terms with him and he's alive, I suggest you ask him, what are some things he's read that he enjoyed?
Yeah, he's just a very, go work out on his friend's farm, go wrench on stuff in the garage, but he's just a very unique individual.
He sounds like he is. The lines are very amusing, and I think a next good conversation for you to have with him, you may say he's just a simple man like this or that, but I'm willing to bet he could tell you some things he's read. I would venture to guess he can probably recite some things by memory. I bet he has some things by heart.
Well, Michelle, have that conversation with your father, and thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Sue, who's calling from Beverly. Sue, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. When you read that first poem by Yeats, mm-hmm. you suggested that we listen to the vowels and the consonants. And that caught me by surprise. So I tried, but I did not succeed. I got visuals with every phrase. There was the sound of bees, and there was some midnight sparkles or something, and a physical awareness of the place that just carried me away, and I loved it, and I imagined being in his shoes in this cabin, away from everyone, I presumed alone, without family or friends with him, and just absorbing that environment. And when the poem was over, I thought, well, wait a minute, what happened to the consonants and the vowels? But then when the Jabberwocky came up, I paid total attention to the consonants and the vowels because I couldn't get visuals because I don't know what the words mean. So my question is being able to attend to both of those a skill that one can train oneself to have?
The answer is yes, and I think you're doing more of it than you think, Sue. One reason the images are vivid is that whether you're paying attention to it consciously or not, the rhythms and the vowel paths and consonant sounds are helping it seem more impressive. I mean, the first three or four words of the poem are, I will arise. Well, I and rise have the same vowel. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree. So the repetition of go echoes the repetition of I will arise now and go to Innisfree. And I'm not sure it's an image of somebody getting up and walking or taking the train to Innisfree, but it feels physical because the physical nature of the vowels and consonants themselves, as you say it, I will arise and go now. And the last line of that stanza, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. In the bee-loud glade. And just like I will arise has one set of sounds in common, to live in the bee-loud glade and live alone in the bee-loud glade. So whether you're conscious of it or not, the sounds are helping make the images feel more visual and more real.
Sue, thanks so much for that call. Robert, you divide this book into four sections, and each section features poems that highlight sort of particular elements that you identify of poetry. And you call these four sections freedom, listening, form, and then the fourth one is dreaming things up. And rather than go through each of these sections, I wanted to ask you about listening, which talks about poems and their melodic patterns and cadences of sentence and words. And can you say something? And there's a poem in this section which I wanted you to read, and that's William Carlos Williams' To Waken an Old Lady.
Sure. To waken an old lady. Old age is a flight of small cheeping birds skimming bare trees above a snow glaze, gaining and falling. I'm sorry, I'll start again. Old age is a flight of small cheeping birds skimming bare trees above a snow glaze, gaining and failing, they're buffeted by a dark wind. But what? On harsh weed stalks, the flock has rested. The snow is covered with broken seed husks, and the wind tempered by a shrill piping of plenty.
Mm. So you talk about some poems beginning with sound. Tell me what you mean by that. It seems like this is one of those poems.
Well, it always knocks me out when I get to the trees glaze at the end of that first sentence. Old age is a flight of small cheeping birds skimming bare trees above a snow glaze. Skimming bare trees above a snow glaze. Mm. And the way glaze ends after trees, it's not always easy to say why a thing feels so great. But for me, it does. And the snow is covered with broken seed husks. Snow and broken have the same vowel sound, and covered in seed husks have the same consonant sound. So on harsh weed stalks, the flock has rested. And weed stalks also anticipates. On harsh weed stalks, the flock is rested. The snow is covered with broken seed husks, and the wind tempered by a shrill piping of plenty. And I thought it was very important in this section called Listening to have poems like this one that are not in rhyme and meter. Mm. Williams titled several of his poems Metrical Figure. Mm. And I think it's important to listen to so-called free verse and hear how intense he's making the sounds. So it's important to have poems like this one in a section called Listening.
Mm. You mentioned earlier, and I wanted you to read another poem. There's a few parodies of poems, and there's a great parody of a William Carlos Williams poem early in the collection, which I love. It's by Kenneth Locke called
Kenneth Coke.
Sorry, Kenneth Coke, called Variations on a Theme by William Carlos Williams. I just love this.
Well, the Williams is so short. Many people know the Williams. The Williams poem is called This Is Just to Say. It's like a refrigerator note poem. This is just to say, I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet, and so cold. And Kenneth Coke writes, Variations on a Theme by William Carlos Williams. 1. I chopped down the house that you had been saving to live in next summer. I am sorry, but it was morning, and I had nothing to do, and its wooden beams were so inviting. 2. We laughed at the hollyhocks together, and then I sprayed them with lye. Forgive me. I simply do not know what I am doing. 3. I gave away the money that you had been saving to live on for the next 10 years. The man who asked for it was shabby, and the firm March wind on the porch was so juicy and cold. Finally, 4. Last evening we went dancing, and I broke your leg. Forgive me. I was clumsy, and I wanted you here in the wards where I am the doctor. And Williams was by profession a doctor, and he was also a kind of charming, unconscious male chauvinist pig in a certain way. He certainly enjoyed being a man, and he enjoyed being charming and saying, whoops, I ate the plums that you were probably saving for breakfast. And Coke, in a way that's affectionate and really takes the mickey out of him, just exposes him.
I love it.
That, yes, and the way that Williams just enjoys feeling that he will be forgiven and that he's a doctor and he speaks with a certain kind of male authority. And
it's wonderful and funny, but it does raise the question how we can use the poetry of others to write new poetry that is...
Sure, like Michelle's father. You know, Michelle's father who had read, I don't know whether it was Gilbert and Sullivan or whatever it was. And already in this little conversation of ours, we've had Pound making fun of the Lake Isle and Coke making fun of Williams's This Is Just to Say. And parody like that is a tribute. And if you find yourself making fun of a kind of music or an actor, wanting to imitate an actor's mannerisms, once you start making fun of any work of art, you're in its spell. You've started to, and these are, to me, are very affectionate as well as funny and penetrating parodies. So I think one of the ways you relate to people you like and to works that you like is to make fun of them.
You've been, you've worked so hard and done so much great work over the years to sort of get poetry out there in the public consciousness. But how are we doing generally as a society in our public education system, for example?
The public education system probably should follow the great local school here in our Kenmore Square neighborhood, the Boston Arts Academy. Art is a very central, fundamental form of learning. Poetry is right at the center of human intelligence, that ability to make a rhythm or a cadence that will preserve knowledge or perception. I assume that has a tremendous evolutionary anthropological importance. And in school, I think if you can teach kids how to play an instrument, learn a foreign language, and read poetry, you'll have a generation of great medical doctors and engineers and scientists.
Hear, hear. Robert Pinsky, his new book is called Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. Robert Pinsky, always a delight to have you. Thanks so much for coming in.
It was fun, Anthony. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Robert Pinsky is a professor of poetry at Boston University, poetry editor for Slate Magazine, and the former U.S. Poet Laureate. Coming up, stick with us. Bill Littlefield is here to talk sports. I'm Anthony Brooks with Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.